Hello and welcome to the Travel Diaries podcast. I'm Holly Rubenstein. I'm a travel and entertainment journalist. And here each week, I'll be speaking to a very special guest about the seven chapters in their life's travel diaries. From their earliest childhood travel memory and the first place they fell in love with, to their hidden gem and what's at the top of their travel bucket list. We'll be uncovering their adventures around the world and the travel experiences and destinations that have shaped their lives. So welcome to the season four finale, episode 51. Oh, thank you for sticking with me. I've had so much fun this season and it's just been such a necessary tonic to lockdown. And I hope it has been for you too. I don't want to speak too soon, but hopefully this will be the last season recorded during a lockdown in my lifetime, I hope. Fingers crossed. But even though it's been a really challenging time, how wonderful it has been to connect with all of you and travel around the world from our armchairs. So thank you. Right, today's guest, wow, this is a big one and quite an episode. One of the most famous and successful chefs in the world and in history, it's Heston Blumenthal. It was actually an unforgettable travel experience that inspired Heston to become a chef in the first place. But his story is remarkable. It's not what you'd think. He's entirely self-taught and was working other odd jobs all the way up until his late 20s when he bought a small pub in Bray in Berkshire, which he called the Fat Duck, or in this episode he calls it quite a lot the Duck. And it went on to be awarded 3 Michelin stars and be named the world's best restaurant. A food pioneer, he's been dubbed the Willy Wonka of cuisine, fascinated by the science behind the cooking, which has led to world-famous dishes like snail porridge, parsnip cereal, and bacon and eggs ice cream. Oh, and did you know that it was Heston who invented one of my favourite things to eat ever? The triple cooked chip. That was him. And of course, now emulated throughout the world. This is definitely an unusual episode. Yes, we cover travel. It's a fundamental part of Heston's food, and it was so fun to hear about some of the weird and wonderful things he's eaten on his travels. Not all of them happy memories, I should add. But honestly, I really felt like I was speaking to a true genius in this chat. It's hard to find another way to describe it. And so we also cover off the meaning of life and philosophy and quantum physics and scientific theory. He's determined to push himself and others to think beyond the confines of what we know already when it comes to food and when it comes to life. And so I went away really taking a lot from our conversation, and I really hope that you do too and that you enjoy it. So here's a culinary legend, Heston Blumenthal. Heston Blumenthal, welcome to the Travel Diaries. Thank you so much for joining me today. Actually, I should say bonjour, Heston, because you're joining me from France.
Ah, bonjour, Oli. like Eston, you leave the H out.
Eston.
So bonjour, Oli.
So you're out there full time now?
Yes, we've been living here for just about 2 years now.
How are you finding it?
I love it here. It's sort of, several reasons why I'm being here. Part of it is almost like just turning a new chapter in terms of my career and my passion and what I believe in. And I found that what was happening, you know, I achieved more than I could have ever imagined. I never had any plans on, I thought maybe I'd get a Michelin star one day, you know, let alone the 3 stars and yeah, all the other awards that came with it. And along with that was found myself sort of a bit like a hamster on the wheel, you know, 600 odd staff for me, everything was about the importance of human imagination and creativity. And I just happened, I'll come onto this in our travel chat, to be sparked by an experience I had as a teenager in a restaurant that's 15 minutes down the road from here. And it was like I fell down a sort of multi-sensory rabbit hole into this magical wonderland. And that memory stayed with me so powerfully that as I got into cooking, it got under my skin and in my blood. And then opened the duck. And for many reasons, you know, in our lives, we have so many moments that create an opportunity to react to, and that reaction then changes the course of the next, you know, to the next moment. It's that action and reaction and vice versa that I started to realize, maybe through accessing this incredible memory I had of that moment in the restaurant, and I was building this memory, kind of got more colorful as I got more interested in food. And I realized I was trying to recreate an emotion, my emotional connection at that time, without kind of realizing it. Then I started to realize in the late 90s that what we see, what we hear, what we taste, what we feel, what we think, what we imagine, all linked to our memory, drive our heavily influence our flavor preferences, you know, the foods that we like and we don't like, and how we react to that food. So just by changing the font, for example, you can change the taste of a glass of wine. It's a great simple experiment, or a cup of coffee, by listening to different pieces of music, by somebody sitting in front of you with a different colored jumper, by the weight of the cup, or, you know, somebody that talks where they really pronounce their it's a sharper sort of, or they pronounce their consonants more, or the speed of somebody's voice, the temperature. There are so many things. It's such a complex thing that I've realized this was an incredibly fascinating world, that the more I knew, the more I realized I didn't know. But at the same time, there was a business, you know, there was a team of people in order to achieve what, in terms of, I'll never get there, but my imagination, think turning those into sort of surprising moments, and maybe creating it almost like, you know, the movie Ratatouille, that Ratatouille moment where the food critic, that's the holy grail for me, to be able to do that with through food in the way that maybe a musician can do it with music, or an artist with painting, or even a mathematician. You know, these things are mechanisms to express and receive emotion. But then, because of all the intricacies of the team and the business, I found myself working harder and harder, being a hamster on the wheel, to get more projects, to get more revenue in, to fund the things going forward. But then I needed more people to do those projects, which then ended up in this vicious circle. So after 25 years of The Duck, which is this year, this is the 25th year.
Congratulations.
Thank you. I'm still standing. I am... I realized that I focused, as most of us do in life, on the outside in. Mm-hmm. So that means, let's say, in terms of cooking, that's recipes and techniques and plates and what the food looks like, and, you know, all the things outside of us. But I became unaware of how fascinated and obsessed I was becoming of the inside out. So what is our relationship with ourselves and our outside world? Again, a bit like Alice in Wonderland, she has this continual dialogue of questioning. And that's a fascinating way for me to learn and be creative. So by doing this, I've just reflected on the last 25 years and actually see what I was driven by in terms of my imagination and motivation and stuff. Was discovering, while I was pursuing the outside in, techniques and ingredients and you know, all that kind of stuff, and now what I suppose the best way of looking at it is sort of putting the inside out. I'm now flipping and actually focusing with awareness on the inside out into the outside in. And I think it's very relevant especially in the last sort of, you know, nine months to a year, where I think our relationship with the food that we hunted, gathered, procured, grew, prepared, cooked, and ate is one of the most important, influential things on human evolution. Because after breathing, in order to live, you need to drink and eat and then sleep, and then current theory is social connection. And so this relationship with food is so fascinating. And so this has given me, I live in a national park in Provence. So I've got...
Looking at these cypress trees behind you.
Yes, this is my beautiful lab.
Beautiful setting. So you're in your lab. So what am I seeing behind you here? Drawings on the wall.
So these are... A lot of work on is, again, these are all linked to sort of theoretical physics, I suppose. Pi, phi, golden ratio, Fibonacci sequence, the tilt of the earth, magnetic field, gravity. There's vortexes and jellyfish on there. I'm looking at, I didn't expect to get into this, but the if you believe in things like string theory, so everything on this planet is vibrating. There's nothing stationary. And that's generally accepted modern theoretical physics. So everything is vibrating. Everything makes a sound, whether it's audible or inaudible. Everything, light makes a sound. Now, water is the mechanism for all the vibrations to move and to flow. It's incredibly exciting because it is such a massive subject. The very thing that is so simple on the surface in terms of we know what to do with is water.
It's water. And this is your focus at the moment, right?
Yes.
You're specifically really into water right now.
So we drink it, we cook with it, we bathe with it, we need it to manufacture, we need it to, you know, whatever. I mean, we know what to do with it, but we still don't know what it is. How come hydrogen and oxygen, two of the lightest things that we know, you put them together in a certain way and you've got something that's so powerful with a lot that can fight gravity to the extent that a little leaf can grow through a tarmac road, a little plant can push out tarmac.
You've met a fellow water enthusiast here, actually.
Ah, brilliant.
Because, well, I forget the name of the study that you've talked about before. Is it a Japanese study about the water being influenced?
Professor Emoto, yeah.
Yeah. So can you just tell me a little bit about that? Because it's something that I also discovered and it kind of influenced my outlook on things.
Ah, okay, brilliant. I love you asking me this question. I didn't expect these questions. So this
we
is
ought
great.
To get onto your travel diaries at some point, but let's talk about water for now.
So there was a guy called Professor Umaro Emoto. He spent years researching the impact of vibrational energy on water. So what he did was take water from many different sources and he froze the water at minus 20 to minus 25 and then looked at the crystals. Then he projected emotions and written word to it. And the crystals are incredibly different. Then he did a rice experiment, which we've now done 10 times, where you take three jars of rice and in the same rice, the same water. And every morning for a couple of months, you give one love and gratitude. The other one you give useless, idiot, pathetic and negative emotions. And the middle one you ignore. And after a couple of months, this depends on your ability to be able to project. If you say the words, but you need the intent behind them. Mm-hmm. The rice that's been given the love and gratitude, the water on the top of it goes slightly golden, floral, cheesy, fermented in a pleasant way. The one that's been abused goes like an old bit of a stinky cheese, but the one that's ignored rots. And the smell between them is incredible. And we've done this 10 times. And then we've done by playing different, you know, Martin Luther King to one jar of rice and Hitler to another jar of rice. And you can see the difference.
That is incredible.
But the difference is incredible. So there's never nothing. So the vibrations, they never stop. So our conversation now will be in the ether and it will be in people's memories if they've heard it potentially forever.
Yeah.
And so water has this ability. In fact, IKEA a couple of years ago did you can see this on YouTube, bully a plant. And they combined Emoto's work with a guy called Clive Baxter who invented the lie detector machine in the 60s, who wired a plant up to a lie detecting machine. Hmm. And it's only when he had the intent to burn the leaf, he could see the lie detecting machine move.
It just shows how much more involved we need to become in terms of our understanding of how the world works. I mean, yeah. I've been interested in it because we are, as humans, 70% comprised of water, right? Is it 70%?
Absolutely. Yep. 72%, yeah.
And so I have a health condition that was caused by a bacterial illness and it gets worse when the moon is full. My symptoms get a lot worse.
It creates, when you have a full moon, sap rising, it creates inflammation. And this is why it can affect people's moods. I mean, men and women, because that rising moon, if the tides rise, if you think the effect of the moon can make oceans rise, well,
that's exactly what I always say.
In the sea, it's the water. Yeah. Rises.
Exactly. That's what I try. Whenever I've said that to people and I say that my symptoms are worse, but it's a full moon, they think that I sound like a complete lunatic. But I always come back and I say, sorry, if the moon can influence the tides, then the moon can influence the water that's in our body.
Absolutely. And so likewise, so can moods. We have to work on them. The biggest thing that inflames the immune system is unaware stress. Normally, created through defense mechanisms in childhood. And the worst of all is actually not, it is being ignored as a child, which links to the jar of rice. Because Emuto says, imagine if our emotions can do that to rice, it's the water. What can they do to ourselves? The bully a plant campaign that IKEA have done in Singapore, kids bully one plant and give love to the other plant and they see the plant dying. And so inflammation of our immune system generated by anxiety. And we're living in a world where we're becoming increasingly anxious, but it's when we're not aware of it. At least if we're aware of it, we can try and work on it. It's not easy. I'm not saying that at all. So this is more relevant than ever before. When that mental health levels get that high, what do? We're going to put everyone on Prozac. You know, thank God for modern medicine and vaccines and chemotherapy and things like this, because when we're in an emergency, we've got stuff to deal with it. But at the same time, we've got to be looking at preventative, but not by telling people what's good for them or not, because then that's judgmental. And funny enough, Professor Muto did an interview about smoking, and I'm not suggesting that we start smoking by any stretch of imagination. Emuto said the worst thing on a packet of cigarettes is smoking kills. That's the worst than the cigarette, because the government are happy to take the money. You buy the cigarettes. If you have an issue yourself with smoking, if you want to stop enough, you can stop. But if you can't stop, but you want to stop, or you're in conflict with yourself, you're spending money on a packet that's telling you you're useless and you're pathetic. So it's
embodying a trauma every single time.
Exactly.
That you smoke a cigarette.
Exactly. And Gabo Mate says something like the 99 times in increase in likelihood of cancer. Smoking increases your potential cancer. So we've all got cancer cells in our body, but they're dormant. When you have unaware stress, you get an inflammation of your immune system, and that's like lighting the fire.
Yeah, we've got so much more that we need to wrap our heads around, don't we?
Yeah, amazing. I mean, life is beautiful. It's just got to dig deep.
Right. Well, that's a good cue for us to start go through your travel diary tested. Let's start at the very beginning first.
Yes.
Chapter one is your earliest childhood travel memory. What would that be?
Cornwall. It was going to Cornwall. It was waking up at middle of the night, like maybe 3 a.m. In those days, it took hours to get there. We had an estate. So the back seat went down, and I can remember lying in I think they were sleeping bags, my sister and I looking out the back window. But I remember the lights in London going past, so we were going backwards as a windscreen wiper was making that whirring, scraping noise, and the rain was pattering on the window. And my dad was driving, and there was something really sort of, I don't know if it's because it was my dad, but the feeling of feeling cozy and protected. It was raining outside. We're going on holiday, and the movement of the brake. And I can remember the actual feeling of it.
Yeah.
We'd always have an argument, my sister and I, somewhere on the way there, where she'd accused me of taking more air than her because I was bigger than her. And then my parents once or twice kicked us out of the car and drove off. They basically saw us seeing it, and then they came back and picked us up. And
what part of Cornwall did you go to?
I remember the hotel was called the Seacroft Hotel, Prey Sands. I think it was that sort of area. My memories are sort of, there was a cliff walking down the steps onto the beach, windbreaker. I remember bashing the windbreaker in and sitting with loads of sand, and my dad had sandwiches out of tinfoil and the blue thermos flask with the tea. There's a particular flavor that tea has in a plastic flask.
Is it a worse flavor, would you say, or is it just a particular flavor?
Well, yeah, I think if you don't grow up with it, if you grow up with fine teas that are brewed at the right temperature and they're harvested, you know, from a very biodynamically, yeah, blah, 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 it might be a bit of a shock. But if you grow up with that, I haven't had actually tea from a thermos flask for a very long time, but I can still remember there's a taste that it has. So I probably find it quite, it is its own thing. It's a bit like tin tuna, I suppose, is compared to, you know, bluefin tuna cooked to its blue in the middle. And then a very fond food memory, which actually wasn't my earliest food memory, but very fond food memory, was sitting at the back of an old purple Cortina with a big front seat, like it was a sofa, massive steering wheel, and the boot was open, and my sister and I would sit wrapped in a towel, having climbed up back up to the top of the cliff, eating a warm Cornish pasty out of a brown paper bag. I think I remember that as well. So we used to go there.
And they're happy memories?
Yeah, so much so that actually when we moved to Australia when we renovated, did a major renovation of the duck, and I wanted something, yeah, I wanted to evolve, for the duck to catch up with my beliefs, or catch the duck up. Before, when we reopened after Australia, the menu of the Fat Duck, I changed it to a map.
Right.
And it's a map of an imaginary island, and it's a day's holiday for me as a child. Oh. And within that day, you know, it's a bit like, you know, sometimes when you say your perfect day, and then people, they don't do all those things in one day. You put them in. So it's,
yeah,
based on things that I remember. I'm not saying they all necessarily happened, but they could have happened. So it's a story, and the light above every table changes from morning to night. So you wake up, go drive down to Cornwall, you wake up, you have breakfast, and then the light goes, and then you go to the beach, who's first to see the sea. And there's all these little, you know, these little sort of memories that are connected. And then we're after the been the sea, the walk in the woods, because I remember if it's raining, you'd go to see Cornwall, there was a castle somewhere. I had this memory of walking in the woods, and then have dinner. So go to a pub and then get ready for bed. So we had this dish called counting sheep, and then you dream, and then you get the sweet shop, which is just the key filling with excitement.
So imaginative, and it just like puts a smile on your face immediately just thinking about it. I want to go on that journey.
So yes, when we reopened after Australia, it was my childhood memory of holidays in Cornwall.
Love that. Right, let's move on to chapter two.
Yes.
That is the first place that you fell in love with.
The Regent Snack Bar in the Edgware Road.
Really?
It was left field, wasn't it? We lived between sort of Edgware Road and Paddington, and my gran, every Saturday morning, would drag my sister and I was probably 7 or 8, my sister would have been 5 or 6, to Church Street Market, which was a bric-a-brac. I mean, see how old I am now, it was like Steptoe and Son, people selling junk off the back of a horse-drawn carts, and my gran and her neighbour, her best friend, would sort of elbow each other and sort of make jokes and have nicknames for the different traders, and so we'd have to be dragged around this, yeah, old rugs and bits. What we thought was just it's the last thing you wanted to really see as a you know, 7 or 8 year old child.
Yeah.
However, on the way back, we would walk past Regent Snack Bar, and it was this little Sicilian-run ice cream parlor, Art Deco. So you can imagine they had sort of red and yellow panels with chrome framework, and there was a big plastic ice cream cone over the door, and sort of curved window, a hole in the wall window with curved glass going into it, or you could walk in. I don't think they had many varieties, but I remember getting some ice cream, and my sister and I, it was in a tub, and a couple of guys in white coats would scrape the ice cream into the container with like a spade, like an aluminium scraper, and holding this brown paper bag with this pot, this tub of ice cream in it, walking home. It was probably a 10-minute walk, but it seemed like days. We had to wait to get home to eat it. So that when I look back, and this is the beauty again of memory, and this with holidays, it depends how we view. I think we should look at how we view holidays and travel and our relationship with the moment we're in. For me, our endocrine system, which is our hormonal emotional system, drives our emotions, and in turn drives our actions, and our actions in turn is cause and effect, influence our emotions. Mm-hmm. And our endocrine system can argue that we evolved to protect us. So we're either attracted to things or repelled by them. So you can have things like adrenaline and cortisol, which are stress hormones, which might repel you and give the opportunity to learn, or you can suffer from them. And you have the endorphins, which are the attraction, sort of hormones, or oxytocin, the bonding ones. They're called reward. The endorphins and dopamines, they're called reward hormones.
Yes,
it's because you work for reward. So if you work for something, it's always worth more value. And waiting is working. So if you go on a holiday, it's like waiting for Christmas. You should really value. You could either just be moaning that you've still got 3 months to wait. I can't believe it. Value the excitement, because now your holiday is not a week or 2 weeks. It's actually the moment you think about going on holiday. Just be aware that, and you think you can make it happen, and then you make it happen by booking, and then you just enjoy that journey. But what a lot of people do or have done in the past is they go on holiday, and let's say it's 2 weeks. The moment, the first few days is just getting used to trying to relax. And there's a tipping point. And the moment the shoulders go down and the tipping point happens, oh, I've only got 7 days left now. So,
oh, yeah, we're all guilty of that.
You know,
yeah.
So if you could approach it differently, I think you could get a lot more value from the holiday.
Extrapolating out from that, what I think is quite interesting is that idea of the endorphins versus the cortisol, like the positive energy versus the negative energy.
Yeah.
In that it really seems to correlate what you're saying about being present and grateful and experiencing the moment.
100%.
And do you think that we're at risk then of becoming more dominated? I mean, already we're more dominated by cortisol, of course,
yes,
but like even more dominated by that, because of the fact that we're looking at things through the medium of our phones, through the medium of gratification that's coming through validation, through likes, through social media.
You said it. You said that so eloquently, and much more eloquently and efficiently than I could have done. Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. When we say we, obviously we're not saying everybody, but this is a great opportunity to realize that and use what we might consider to be negative. We need adversity in life, because without adversity, we've got nothing to work on. So when human beings say that, what is normal? Well, our baseline is suffering. Every human being suffers. That's why positive thinking, it's all very well to be aware you're positive thinking, but if you just positive think, if you don't allow negative emotions to come out and observe them, then you bury them. And then we go back to this inflammation, stress builds up. Mm-hmm. So we do need, it doesn't mean to say we deserve pain, but every human being suffers.
That's like the Buddhist philosophy, isn't it? That's the baseline, like life is suffering.
Life is like, it is. I mean, and that's how, from a hormonal point of view, without suffering, we've got nothing. That's working for reward. So in a really silly, small way, I suffered having to go through that bric-a-brac market and walk back with my ice cream.
Yeah.
But without that suffering, I wouldn't appreciate it. It's like with water, you know, I know what it's like to be. I know I can remember the thirstiest I've ever been. And I can remember how much I appreciate the water I had, the first sip I had after I was so thirsty. However, I don't know what it's like to be dying of thirst. I can only begin to imagine how valuable does that become?
Mm-hmm.
And that's your sort of, the fallout of us making our lives generally in the Western world and the modern world so comfortable is that we now project our fears into the smaller things in the future that could go wrong. And talk about Buddhism, there's a fantastic quote I saw by the Dalai Lama not too long ago. He said, what confused him most about humanity? He said, man, meaning man or woman. He said, because they sacrifice their health in order to make money. Then they sacrifice their money to get their health back.
Yeah.
They don't live in the present. They live in the future projected from the past. They live as if they're never going to die.
Yeah.
And then they die never having really lived. I thought, well, that's
powerful profound. Thing. Yeah. Sometimes I think with things like that, you can read them and be like, whoa. And then it's so easy to then just push it to the back of your mind and then just carry on in your kind of negative cycle. Yeah. So it's good to reflect on those things from time to time.
Yeah. And if you can't value death, death is what gives value to life. That's not being morbid. You know, if you could live forever, so you could never die, well then life would then become less valuable. But it's very easy to sit and have this conversation and then you know, this afternoon something will come up and I'll be under and I'll get all stressed and, you know.
Yeah, like we can't get your internet browser to work properly or like
it's the biggest disaster.
Chapter 3 is the place where you learnt the most about yourself, as we're being quite introspective at the moment.
That would be my experience as a 15-year-old coming to the restaurant that I'm 15 to 20 minutes away from, the Hostel de Beaumanière in Les Baux, Provence. And as we discussed, you know, I'd never experienced anything remotely gastronomic before. And this place is in a magical spot. It's a UNESCO site, mm-hmm. in a valley of bauxite rocks, with olive groves, with a medieval town on the top of the rock just above it. It's an old Provençal farmhouse. And I remember sitting on this terrace with things like the noise of the feet of the waiting staff crunching on the gravel, the crickets fill the air, the noise of this intoxicating sound of crickets and smell of lavender and the crunch of the gravel of the feet of the waiting staff and the wine list that was like a billboard and the cheese trolley that was like a chariot. I mean, they're pouring sauces into souffles and carving legs of lamb at the table and the chink of the glasses. Now I fell down a multi-sensory rabbit hole into some wonderland. And that's when cooking and eating got under my skin. And I kept on accessing that memory and telling more stories about it. So it became like a fishing story. I've embellished it. I've been back there since many times. Okay. It's still magical. And I think with the duck, it had such a profound effect on me that has lasted, that the effect became more profound over the years. And this is, again, when we can be sensorially in the moment. So let's say whether you're watching a sunset or whether you're just going for a walk in your local park or through the woods, if you can feel the twigs cracking underfoot and you can smell damp leaves or you can hear a bird tweeting or feel the wind on your skin, all of these things anchor your awareness and your connection with that moment.
Yeah.
So if then you want to take a photo, for me, what if you want to take a photograph, I think the photograph becomes so much more valuable once you've anchored your emotional awareness of your moment in time. Then take a photo, and that will influence how you take the photo. So then when you look back at that photo, you can remember the moment and you might even be able to remember the emotion. And when you can do that, time expands. Just because you've been on holiday or you've been for a walk, mm-hmm. that walk is still there and that walk can still grow and become more rich, and you can learn from your memory. So it's like you're continuing to expand time. Yeah. And that's what the Beaumanière, that's what it did for me.
And from there, a love of food just grew.
And that was it. Whether I liked it or not, it got under my skin and in my blood. And in fact, with the duck, I remember doing the Fat Duck Cookbook, which took years. But one of the things I was asking is, how come I came up with this phrase, multi-sensory, eating and cooking is a multi-sensory experience, in the late 90s. I didn't realize that not only the gastronomic world, but the neurological, neuroscience world hadn't considered this. All the work was being done on how one sense affected the other, but you can't separate them. And I think my first paper I was involved in was we made a, it was Sussex University, a guy, a Professor Martin Yeomans, and we did it with smoked salmon, frozen smoked salmon mousse, or called it smoked salmon ice cream. When it was called smoked salmon ice cream, it was perceived to be 20% more salty because the name changed the expectations. If you expect sweet, get salt. The contrast is much greater than if you expect salt, get salt. And so I kept on thinking, well, how? Why am I so fascinated about this? Why? I think because the fat duck, in many ways, was so so far away, millions and millions of miles away from the Beaumanière. I didn't have bauxite cliff. I didn't have a medieval village. I didn't have crickets and lavender. I didn't have an olive grove and a fountain in the back. I didn't have any of that. It was a little, very old building on the side of a village.
It was a tumble down pub that you kind of picked up.
Tiny little thing. And I think because I was caged, but I lived in that tiny kitchen. My memory, it's almost like that helped to make that memory even more precious. And I think I was wanting to access my rabbit hole moment of the Beaumanière, but because I didn't have the bells and whistles and stuff, I did it through headphones and sprays and all the stuff that I now see on TV, you know, all of the Willy Wonka type creative stuff. I think that the combination of that moment in the Beaumanière and all the other things that happened to me, but my experience and my reaction to it, but that moment in the Beaumanière and then the fat duck not having any of those things the Beaumanière had, but what it did have was my imagination.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Today's episode is supported by Airbnb, and what a great partnership. If you're a longtime listener of the Travel Diaries, you probably know that we love to put our home on Airbnb when we're traveling. Like last autumn when we took the family to Puglia, we put our house on Airbnb when otherwise it would just be sitting empty, which meant that we earned some extra money that went towards our flights and maybe some souvenirs too. Hosting on Airbnb for us is also a family affair. My mum is an Airbnb superhost. She regularly has guests stay in her little chalet in her garden, and my dad, who lives in France, has his home on Airbnb so that when he comes back to visit, he is earning some extra money while he's away. My dad is 80 and he only started hosting on Airbnb a couple of years ago. So hopefully that shows you how straightforward the whole experience is. He found it so easy to list his house that I think he's got all his pals signing up now too. And it really is straightforward. You can choose whether you want to rent out your entire home or just some rooms. Alex and I, for example, list our spare bedroom and that works really well for us. So if you have a trip coming up and you want to earn some extra money while you're away, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.co.uk/host. That's airbnb.co.uk/host. Thank you to Airbnb.
I feel like it's important for me to point out that you failed your chemistry O-level, didn't you?
Yes.
And now you're a fellow of the Royal Society of chemistry. Is that right?
Amazing. Yes. Yeah. And yeah. I was listed as one of the 175 most influential scientists of all time, according to the Royal Society of Chemistry.
That is amazing. Rightly so, but what an incredible achievement. And also, you didn't take that conventional route. You got the fat duck at 29, was it? Wasn't the fat duck at the time.
Yeah.
By that point, I imagine most chefs have been in a kitchen for, you know, 10 years working their way up. So you didn't take a conventional route from the cooking or from the scientific approach. I mean, there wasn't a background there. So how did it happen? How did you end up with 3 Michelin stars and being the best restaurant in the world? Like, what happened?
What's that saying? One thing led to another. I just think a whole many reasons. It's like, you know, what's that phrase that's saying it took 25 years to be an overnight success.
Right. Let's pause there and move on to chapter 4. That is your all-time favorite destination, the big one.
I think the beautiful thing about imagination and memory is that absolute favorite can change, just like your favorite food. So I'm talking at the moment, my absolute favorite place in the entire world is right here.
In Provence. And just tell me a little bit about the local area, what it's called, if people go and visit it, what they should do.
I'm in a national park called Les Alpilles, which is where Les Baux is. So if you imagine Marseille, take a car from Marseille, it's about 50 minutes west of Marseille. Mm-hmm. And the biggest town in Les Alpilles is Saint-Rémy de Provence, which is where again Van Gogh's hospice is. And it's basically, they're not mountains. Les Alpilles is the baby Alps. Imagine they're hills, fairly big hills with rocks. So to call it mountains is a bit of an overstatement, but it's full of olive trees and vineyards and lots of honey makers and fruit growers and stuff like that.
And that beautiful light that you mentioned.
The light is unbelievable. And the Mistral, so this is quite a unique wind that blows down the Rhone Valley. And then when it hits Avignon, flat land, it comes out in this hurricane, what do you call them? Yeah, the hurricane. Tornadoes or whirlwinds. And you can see the leaves when the Mistral picks up, when it's low, the leaves actually you don't need to sweep the leaves because it brings them all into a pile. But when it gets powerful, it does the same with chairs and tables, but it blows the clouds away. It blows the pollen away. So you have, and then the bauxite rock, Les Baux is after the name of bauxite, is incredibly porous and incredibly reflective. And the Igalier here, the town is actually originally called Land of Water, Aqualeria.
All right. So is that why you've set up this lab to look at water there?
It's another sort of, you know,
a full circle moment.
Living the dream. It's a full circle moment. Yeah.
As Oprah would say.
Yeah. Full circle moment.
Well, chapter 5 then is your hidden gem, a place that you love that maybe the listeners don't know that well.
It's just down the road from here.
Yeah.
There's a little monastery. Mm-hmm. Monastery Epiphany. I don't believe in religion, but I believe in the belief of religion.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. Yeah.
But I can see how religion can be incredibly beneficial. Like everything's an object. So like a telephone has potential. Religion has potential. Everything has, but our relationship with that object is the key thing. So I when I say I believe in the belief of religion, you know, people that collectively believe in something can achieve incredibly positive and incredibly negative actions as a result of that shared belief. Mm-hmm. However, somebody, a very good friend of mine who is a professor, he's from Thailand, but a fantastic theoretical physics professor, who has done a lot of work on the connection between quantum theory and Buddhism. So the crossover of sort of the appliance of science to spirituality, let's say. Yeah. He said to me if you find any little, if you find any little churches or chapels that have thick walls that are old, try and meditate in them. This is a few years ago. He said, oh, okay. He said, I asked him why. He said, because the frequency of belief over the years would also be in that stone.
Yeah.
So I've got an electric mountain bike, which I adore, and I take it up the rocks. I go once or twice a week. It's and on the way back, I come down. I do it once a week. I come down, but it's closed now. Past this, when I say monastery, imagine this little Provençal house, mm-hmm. one story. Mm-hmm. You can fit maybe 20 people in. It's got coir matting, straw chairs, and there's a little altar at the front of it. And I just go in there and I sit for, I don't know, 5, 10, 15, 20 minutes and just sit and meditate. And it's so easy to drop into meditation because I can hear a high-pitched frequency.
Wow.
From the brick. The walls are really, really thick.
Amazing. You know,
it's amazing.
So that is your special place.
Yes, that's my hidden gem.
Oh, I love that. So in contrast then, chapter 6 is your worst travel experience. Is there a place that you remember for the wrong reasons?
Well, no, I've never... You know, those nightmares you see on TV, people, they wait for their holiday and then they get stuck in an airport for a week or 2 weeks and never get there. I've been stuck in an airport for a day, but not, I've never had that experience. Or, you know, you get a horrible bug or virus or food poisoning and, you know, which completely disabilitates you. So it's obviously you'd rather be at home. I haven't had anything like that happen. And coming back to perspective, the way I see now, I went to Turkey not too long ago. I went to a smart hotel in Turkey. The people, we went as my wife and our daughter. It was a lovely hotel, and people nodded. The staff nodded, but no one spoke English. But it was an international resort, an international hotel. And that was sort of fine until realizing that when you sort of we just it was relaxing, exercising. We just chilled in the room, watched a movie, played with our daughter, and ordered room service. We order a kebab, and the housekeeping turns up. You know, you couldn't ask for anything. You couldn't ask for anything because they wouldn't even understand what a glass of water was. So to point to things And I felt myself getting really frustrated and thinking, God, how can this be an international hotel when you know, you're paying this money and they don't tell people that it was not a uniquely Turkish hotel. And then when I thought, hang on a second, why don't we just embrace it? Just embrace it. And maybe it means you have more privacy. So I sort of flipped it on its head. And we had a fantastic time in the end. So I've had some trips that which were under the pretext, or they were TV travel trips. So Siberia, traveling across Russia in a plane that was falling apart in a wooden shed in freezing cold Siberia with no toilet and.
Wow. And yeah, that's intense.
Very strange conditions. However, I was filming. So if it was a holiday that was, I think is expect, what do you expect out of a holiday? That's the thing. And we put such high
expectations, don't we, on things?
Yeah. Well. Yeah. And you could focus on the kettle not working or something like that. And then get really frustrated. In fact, again, it comes back to perspective.
Totally. Oh, and I have to ask you very quickly, what is the worst thing you've ever eaten? Is there something that sticks out?
There's two. I mean, I've again, through TV, I've tasted many things that many people would just, you know, cringe at.
But I can see your face thinking about it.
One was fermented shark. They were both in Iceland, actually. One was fermented shark, and it was a ceremony. It was all part of they have a culling season, and it was hanging up and we were filming, and it was in this little cabin by the side of Iceland. Beautiful, beautifully bleak, but beautiful. And to put this in my mouth, I thought I was having an anaphylactic shock, but I don't even know what an anaphylactic shock feels like. But my whole chest started to contract. The other one was also in Iceland. It was something called scatter, which is skate, that they used to pee on. And the ammonia would then preserve the fish. Now, I don't know what they do to develop, get the ammonia, because ammonia is a preservative. So they use ammonia in baking biscuits. Classic biscuits. I'm not necessarily digesters, but of the ilk, they put ammonia in the baking and then it bakes off, it all evaporates, but it preserves the biscuit. So this preserves the fish. So the flesh looks beautifully shiny and fresh. I'm on this boat and I put this piece of fish in my mouth. And for the first time in my life, my throat took on a life of its own. And it basically told me to get stuffed. I didn't vomit. As the fish went down, it's like my throat created its own catapult. And I had no control over it. I saw this piece of fish just being like fired out of my mouth, completely undigested. And I thought, how can people eat this? But the older generation, some of the older generation do, and this is an interesting point where people say this is disgusting. It might be disgusting to you. There is no food inherently disgusting, because if it were, nobody would eat it. So our flavor preferences, they evolve through our life, you know, and to try and change somebody's flavor preference, it can be a very, very challenging, difficult thing to do. But if you get somebody to eat something they hadn't eaten before and would have been scared before, but actually really like it, that's a great feeling.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And I guess that's like a fundamental food philosophy of you, Heston.
Yes. It's not trying to revolt people, not trying to make them go, it's actually discovery, to try and use curiosity for them to discover in the process.
Yeah. Right. Well, we are on to the final chapter of your travel diaries, chapter 7, the destination that is at the top of your travel bucket list. Is there a place that you've not yet been that you're really excited to go to?
There's a few. I would say that my overriding or main sort of interest now is my connection with myself and the planet around me. So my connection with myself and nature. Mm-hmm. My connection with other human beings, and in particular, my connection with other human beings or the other cultures' connections with the foods that they fish, farm, hunt, harvest, grow, whatever. And so, you know, under the first head of my connection with nature, I'd love to go to the Galapagos, because I think, you know, Charles Darwin to the unbelievable example of how humans' incredible ability to join the dots when they can observe.
Yes.
I'd love to go to the Galapagos. I would also love to see the Northern Lights. I've been to Iceland twice, and I saw them once under a postage stamp hole in the clouds. I mean, it was just so close. They were there, but I couldn't see them. I'd love to see the Northern Lights. Then from a food point of view, there's some tribe. I'd like to spend time with some tribes to learn again, you know, just the correlation between hunting, gathering, fire making, preserving, processing, cooking and eating, and music. I'd love to look at that. But in terms of countries, Korea, I'd love to experience, learn more about Korean food. I'd love to go to the Amazon, Peru, and then I'll probably put Indonesia and Polynesia in there as well. So I've been lucky enough to travel, but there's a lot. Yeah, there's a lot to discover.
Fantastic. Well, I hope you're able to start visiting some of those places very soon. Fingers crossed.
Fingers crossed. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Heston. Those were your travel diary. It's been such a pleasure.
Brilliant. Thanks for the questions and letting me talk at you.
Oh, that was the incredible Heston Blumenthal. If you want to hear more from Heston, tune in to his own podcast, Heston's Journey to the Centre of Food, which is available on all podcast apps, and it's great fun. Oh, well, that's a wrap for season 4. Thank you so much again for joining me along the way, wherever you are in the world. I'm so grateful that you've spread the word about the podcast, shared your favourite episodes on your socials, telling your friends, leaving lovely reviews, sending me the most amazing messages. It's been lovely to feel like a little Travel Diaries community is really growing that you've all helped to create during a time when we've otherwise felt pretty disconnected, haven't we? So it's been great. And if you have enjoyed listening to the podcast, do remember to press subscribe on your podcast app. It's free to do that, and you'll then get notified when season 5 begins in the summer. In the meantime, do stay in touch. I'm at Holly Rubenstein on Instagram and Twitter. Some of you have asked me where my first stop is going to be post-lockdown. So it's going to be South Devon, a place that I've never been to. I'm so looking forward to discovering that part of the world. It looks beautiful. And I'm staying at one of the best of British hotels, the Carey Arms, in a self-catering cottage there. So I'll let you know what it's like. I'll be sharing about it on my Instagram, no doubt. Right, I'll love you and leave you. I'll be back in the summer. Take care, stay well, safe travels. Today's episode is supported by Airbnb, and what a great partnership. If you're a longtime listener of the Travel Diaries, you probably know that we love to put our home on Airbnb when we're traveling. Like last autumn when we took the family to Puglia, we put our house on Airbnb when otherwise it would just be sitting empty, which meant that we earned some extra money that went towards our flights and maybe some souvenirs too. Hosting on Airbnb for us is also a family affair. My mum is an Airbnb superhost. She regularly has guests stay in her little chalet in her garden. And my dad, who lives in France, has his home on Airbnb so that when he comes back to visit, he is earning some extra money while he's away. My dad is 80 and he only started hosting on Airbnb a couple of years ago. So hopefully that shows you how straightforward the whole experience is. He found it so easy to list his house that I think he's got all his pals signing up now too. And it really is straightforward. You can choose whether you want to rent out your entire home or just some rooms. Alex and I, for example, list our spare bedroom and that works really well for us. So if you have a trip coming up and you want to earn some extra money while you're away, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.co.uk/host. That's airbnb.co.uk/host. Thank you to Airbnb.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.